Support for WPR comes from the American Society of Landscape Architects Wisconsin Chapter. Dedicated to reimagining the design of outdoor spaces for the well-being of all. Examples at wiasla.com. Support for WPR comes from Milwaukee Film, presenting the 16th Annual Milwaukee Film Festival, featuring local, national, and international films, April 11th through the 25th. Tickets are at mkefilm.org.
Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's about 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday morning, March the 26th. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to Jean Purcell for filling in for me while I was on vacation last week. I'm very happy to be back and very happy to be welcoming in our guest this hour, noted environmentalist Bill McKibben. He changed the way we thought about nature with his book, The End of Nature, more than 10 years ago. He was the first to draw our attention to global warming in that book. He now has a new book out that may change the way we think about the things we buy, the food we eat, the energy we use, and the money that pays for it all. And we will welcome your questions and thoughts for Bill McKibben at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Or you can send your question or comment via email, talk@wpr.org. Talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Bill McKibben will be in Wisconsin this week. He's going to be at an event sponsored by the Wisconsin Humanities Council at 7:30 tomorrow night, Tuesday, March 27th, and will also be appearing at the Schwartz Bookstore in Shorewood on Wednesday night, March the 28th. We'll give you more details on that a little bit later in the program. But now let me welcome our guest. Bill McKibben is the author of the new book, Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. Bill McKibben is a scholar in residence at Middlebury College, an environmentalist, a writer, a frequent contributor to various magazines, including the New York Times, the Atlantic Monthly, Harper's, Mother Jones, the New York Review of Books, and many others. Author of several books, including The End of Nature, The Age of Missing Information, and the just published Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks very much for being with us. So why does an environmentalist or someone known for being an environmentalist write a book that's about the economy?
Well, because I think that our deepest environmental problems, particularly global warming, where I've spent most of my career working, are pretty inextricably linked to the fact of rapid economic growth in our society and now around the world, and that unless we can begin to ask deeper questions about our economy, namely, is more always better, we're going to find it extremely difficult to deal with those environmental problems.
Yeah. So is more always better?
Well, that's what we've said for a very long time. Mm-hmm. That's been the default assumption of our society. In fact, you can tell what a default assumption it is by even listening to, you know, any newscast on the radio. If the economy has gotten larger in the course of a quarter or something, the announcer, though very objective, will always say, good news on the economic front today, gross domestic product is up 3%. And they'll never say, bad news this morning, housing starts have increased 12% or something like that. Default assumption is there for good reason. For much of American history, we were pretty poor and needed more stuff. But that condition, for the most part, ended a while ago. And what's fascinating is to look at the new economic data, new ideas, new research from a lot of economists and sociologists that have begun to indicate pretty clearly that not only is endless economic growth damaging the environment, it's also, and really probably for the last four decades or so, failing to make us in general feel any happier or be any more satisfied with our lives. If anything, that satisfaction is diminishing, and one of the reasons may be the unprecedented affluence in which we now live.
Well, so if more is not better, what is better?
Here's an interesting number. Every year since the end of World War II, pollsters have asked Americans how happy they are with their lives. And the number of Americans who said they were very happy peaked in about 1956 and has gone steadily downhill since, to the point where really only about a quarter of Americans will make that claim now. That's a very odd situation, because in that same five decades, Joy, the amount of stuff that we have has about tripled.
Mm-hmm.
If what we think is correct about the economy was correct, those two curves should move in somewhat the same direction. That they diverge is interesting. And the reason that they diverge, as far as we can tell, is because Americans are feeling a terrific loss of social connection, a terrific loss of community. We have, for instance, far fewer friends than we did five decades ago, on average, close friends. And the reason appears to be pretty closely linked precisely to that new affluence. What did we start doing in the 1950s and keep doing ever since? We moved to the suburbs and built ever bigger houses, and we started acquiring the first of the set of screens that we've been looking into ever since, in effect, isolating ourselves from those around us. And that lack of social connection is what apparently outweighs whatever material gains we've made. Now, the interesting question is there a method, is there some change we might make that might manage to address both these environmental and social problems? And the book argues that we might want to think a lot more closely about making our economies somewhat more local and self-sufficient, both because that would use less energy and because it would force us, in a sense, to build stronger communities where we're more in contact with and more reliant on each other. And hence, we might be able to repair some of both kinds of the damage that our growth economy is causing.
So does that start with buying locally?
Sure. And, of course, the easiest place to start and the place where Americans have begun to start now is food. You all have a famous farmer's market in Madison. Farmer's markets are now the fastest growing part of our food economy around the world. And there are two reasons for that. One, people want good tasting, environmentally responsible food that supports their local farmer. Two, the experience of shopping for that food is different than the experience of shopping in the kind of industrial food system. Sociologists followed shoppers last year, first around supermarkets and then around farmers markets. And what they found was that people in the farmers market had 10 times more conversations in the course of their visit. It wasn't just a different way of, you know, collecting calories.
Mm-hmm.
It was a much richer, much different, wholly different experience.
Well, I do both in front of the Stella Bakery's spot. We can talk about those scones. So besides buying locally at the farmer's market, buying your hardware at the local hardware store as opposed to the discount store?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Anything that's local is, you know, anytime you buy local, you're helping, of course, in many ways. You're keeping money in communities. You're providing more jobs than the Walmart does, so on and so forth. But I think that beyond that, we now need to start thinking about what parts of our economy we can really bring back home.
Yeah.
For instance, not just food, but energy. At the moment, you know, we think of it in much the same way we do food. It's something that travels a very long ways. You know, in the case of energy, we end up having to defend lifelines that go all the way back to the Persian Gulf, or we end up having to hope that the people of the southern Appalachians keep letting us remove the tops of their mountains to get at their coal, and so on and so forth. Instead of having energy that works just the way the TV does, comes from a centralized place, we could also have energy that worked the way the Internet does. I mean, I have solar panels up on my roof. They're tied into the electric grid. When the sun shines, I'm a utility. I'm sending electrons down the line to power my neighbor's refrigerator. When the cloud passes over, then I'm sucking up power like everybody else. That sort of energy equivalent of the internet, or really of the farmer's market, is a much better model in the long run, in part because it's much more resilient, much less vulnerable, can't be taken down by terrorists or by the sudden end of diminution of the oil supply. You can even make the same argument with regard to things like culture and entertainment. I mean, we're used to thinking that music is something that comes from Hollywood or Nashville, mm-hmm. and that we buy it. But, of course, that's a relatively new way of thinking about these things. For the most part, humans used to make most of their own entertainment. At 1900, at the turn of the century, in the state of Iowa alone, there were 1,300 opera houses, 1,300 local music venues.
In Iowa?
In Iowa. I just came across that statistic, and it stuck in my mind. You know, that day may be returning in an era when file sharing and things is beginning to undermine the monopoly that a few big providers have had over our music. The musicians that are starting to make money in the current system are people who are much more like the traveling bards of yore, out making music for people who are sharing it in a group with their neighbors.
We are talking with Bill McKibben. He is author of Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future, talking about how the more affluent we have become, the less happy we are, and how we should be paying more attention to the financial choices we make, considering the environment and our community. Says that there's much that we can do, and that our local communities can do to produce and buy more of our own local food, generating more of our own local energy, even creating more of our own local culture and entertainment. We welcome your thoughts and questions for Bill McKibben at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. She's going to be welcoming in Craig Gilbert, who is the Washington Bureau Chief of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. They'll talk about the latest news out of Washington, including the Iraq troop withdrawal bill passed by the House last week, Karl Rove, the firing of the federal prosecutors, and much more. That's coming up after 9 o'clock. We're talking with Bill McKibben, who you probably remember as the author of The End of Nature. He now has a new book out called Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future, in which he says that more does not make us happier, and more economic growth is linked to environmental problems like global warming, and that there are things that we can do to improve our lives and the environment. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Bill McKibben in Wisconsin this week for a couple of different events. He's going to be at the First Unitarian Church tomorrow night at 7:30 for the Wisconsin Humanities Council event. Schwartz Bookstore in Shorewood at 7 o'clock on Wednesday night. Talking with us right now, and an opportunity for you to talk with him right now at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Mark in Richland Center is with us first. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Good morning. I want to address this issue of a durable future, because it seems that in the world of this market economy, the way that things are driven is that you have to sell more. In order to sell more, the products themselves become inferior, so that you can sell more of them. So now, just two examples. You can't buy M2 tool steel, which is considerably more durable than D2 tool steel, unless you pay a premium because the steel companies want you to buy more of it, of the inferior stuff. You can't even buy a pair of athletic shoes that the soles don't peel off from. And it's not like we've forgotten how to make glue in this country or any place in the world. So what happens is we end up using more of our resources. We spend more of our time and money to buy crap that doesn't even last for us. So I think that the market-driven economy has a problem with it, because selling more stuff isn't necessarily what life is supposed to be about and shouldn't be the measure of our so-called success.
Yeah, Bill McKeown?
And I think that's absolutely right. And one of the things that he points up is we're not even really supposed to think about the durability of either communities or of things that we buy anymore. One of the first businesses to go out of business in many communities were the people who fixed things, because we made goods cheap enough and ubiquitous enough that it became easier, at least for the moment, to simply throw them away and buy another one when they didn't perform or when they became a little outdated. That's a sort of symbol of the reason that we're in some of the environmental trouble that we're in right now. The amount of energy that it takes to produce those new goods is way, way larger than the amount that it would take to fix them when they were broken. And yet the system hardly even allows for that anymore.
Yeah. Talk a little bit more about the term deep economy. That is derived from the deep ecology, a term that you coined in The End of Nature.
The deep economy is a way to say, let's think about what we actually want from our economy, rather than let's just imagine that its only goal is to get bigger. I mean, if you think about economic growth, I mean, the person who contributes the most to it in any given day is probably, say, someone who is driving from their divorce lawyer's office to their chemotherapy appointment and has a spectacular wreck along the way. All of those things contribute an awful lot of money into the economy, and none of them are things that we really want to see going on. We need to be asking questions, and increasingly a small but growing band of economists are asking questions about whether or not we might be better off trying to measure more accurately some other things as well, like human satisfaction, like environmental durability. We've built a very streamlined and powerful economy that works very well on its own terms. That is, it grows fast as long as conditions are optimal. But, you know, conditions seem to be becoming less optimal. That's what the scientists are telling us about climate change, for sure. And we may well, in the not-too-distant future, be much happier with communities and economies that are somewhat more sufficient and that involve much closer connections, tighter connections between people.
Yeah. So, in a way, are you saying if we bought less stuff, we drove our cars less, we had solar panels or in our houses, or used better light bulbs, for example, maybe we hung out and talked with other people at the local bookstore, that we'd all be better off, we'd all be happier, but we'd also maybe stop this global warming scare?
Well, we're not going to stop global warming. And this is the kind, I mean, some of it's already happening and it's going to happen. And this is the sort of long-term response. If we're serious about dealing with global warming, we also need a kind of emergency response. And I want to talk for a minute about the thing I'm spending most of my winter and spring working on, which is, in fact, not promoting this book, but running the first big set of nationwide climate change demonstrations, which will take place around the country on April 14th. There are many of these taking place in Wisconsin. You can find out about all of them at stepitup07.org. And this has been a very interesting process for me, because I'm not by nature an activist, I'm a writer. But about a year ago, I began to despair at how little action was actually taking place. even though Hurricane Katrina and Al Gore's movie had shown us that we needed to act, we still were kind of frozen in time, the same frozen in time place that we'd been really since 1989 when I wrote The End of Nature, which was the first book about climate change. So in early January, working with six students at Middlebury College, where I have a loose connection, we opened a website, stepitup07.org, and asked people to organize these rallies. And we weren't at all clear what would happen. We hoped that if we worked really hard, we might be able to get 100 of them by April 14th. That would have been, you know, much larger than any public outcry over global warming has yet been. As it turns out, not because we're good organizers, but because there was a real desire to do something on the part of people across the country, the thing has kind of exploded in a viral way. As of Friday, I think, we were above something like 1,040 of these demonstrations already scheduled for April 14th in every state in the union, many of them, you know, many of them on church steps or in city parks, and some of them in wildly creative places designed to show exactly what the effects of climate change will be. So, for instance, there'll be thousands of people in blue shirts crowding into lower Manhattan to form a sea of people and show where the water is going to come when it starts to rise, or they're going to be scuba teams doing underwater demonstrations on the endangered coral reefs off Key West, or skiers coming in formation down the dwindling glaciers in the Rockies and the Sierra, on and on and on. Completely fascinating a response by Americans. They're demanding, all of them, that Congress cut carbon 80% by 2050. That's the minimum the scientists tell us is required. And we're beginning to see real movement toward this goal. A week ago, John Edwards released his new energy policy, and that was the first item on the list, 80% by 2050. We're trying to build some momentum, and I think April 14th is going to be a pretty dramatic and interesting day.
Yes, sounds like it. Thanks very much. Cater in Glenflora will be next. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I appreciate this discussion. I'm part of a nonprofit in rural northern Wisconsin. That's part of what we're doing is promoting exactly the things that you're talking about in our community. And there's a lot of things I could ask you, but I guess the one thing I want to ask you is that I find, you know, a good number of people who are aware of these problems and issues and who really want to make real changes in their own life, but run up against all kinds of inertia and habit in terms of, you know, being plugged into a 40-hour-a-week job and having to commute and not having support from community and family and just the whole habit structure of their whole life around things that are not about local sustainable living. And my question is, and this is what we've been struggling with, what kind of things can we do with the individual that's right in front of us to help them and support them in making whatever change in their life that they're willing to make? And this seems to me to be what it comes down to. A lot of people can talk about this, but when it comes down to actually making a change, everybody feels some resistance. Nobody wants to give up their car. Nobody wants to turn their thermostat down. So I'm just wondering if you have any ideas or experience about how to support people in these things.
Absolutely. It's a terrific question. And one of the ways that, one of the things that we've worked on in a lot of places is trying to take first steps that are really win-win for a lot of people. Local food is that way because, A, it's obvious the benefit you're getting. It tastes better. That, you know, the average bite of American food travels about 2,000 miles before it reaches your lips. I've traveled about 2,000 miles this week. I can tell you I'm not feeling all that great about it. And that's pretty much how the strawberry feels too, you know. But also, you create instantly a market for farmers, at the beginning, a few farmers in your neighborhood, and and you begin to create an example of what might be possible. And what's good about that is that this is neither a liberal nor a conservative idea. It's some of both. It's more along the lines of something that a friend of mine in Vermont, where I live, he runs a diner that only serves local food. And he printed up a bunch of bumper stickers that said, "Think globally, act neighborly." Mm. I think that's good advice. Once we get started, once things get rolling, they can begin to change more quickly. Now, what Cater says is very correct. It's difficult because there are structural things built into our economy that make it hard for that change to happen fast enough. Probably the biggest of these is the fact that we don't pay the real price for cheap fossil fuel. We don't pay the price that reflects the incredible damage it's doing to the planet, and hence we end up using it much more of it than we otherwise would. That means that we underwrite the industrial agricultural system that we have, which is highly inefficient in its use of energy. It means that we don't get around to building effective public transit systems, which are completely possible even in rural areas. It means a lot of things don't happen. That's one of the reasons we need things like this StepItUp07.org effort to try to change at a national level a few of the economic forces of gravity that would then make the work at the local level that we really need to do that much easier.
Thank you, Cater, for the call. Diane in Madison is with us now. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I have a comment to make. My friend has a beautifully embroidered, written plaque in her house, and it says, 100 years from now, it will not matter what kind of car you drove, how much money you had in your bank account, what kind of house you lived in, or how much stuff you owned. What will matter is the impact you made on society and one child in your life. Thank you.
You want to react to that, Bill McKibben?
Well, I think it's really pretty true. I think it reflects what it is that in the end matters. I mean, very few people, I think, lie on their deathbeds and reflect, you know, damn, I wish I'd made it to the mall one more time, you know. I think we're much more likely to think back about the relationships with each other and often with the natural world that we did or didn't have. And what those meant to us. We're much more complicated creatures than the kind of want machines that the orthodox economists posit we are.
Thank you very much, Diane. Todd in Hogansville, Georgia, is that right, Todd?
Well, that's where I'm from. I'm actually in Walken, Iowa right now. I picked up your radio station. I'm a truck driver.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was flipping channels and caught the show, and it really piqued my interest. I consider myself a conservative on most issues, but this particular issue right here is something that's pretty close to me. I spend 2 and 3 weeks at a time away from home, away from my wife and children, and I talk a lot.
Oh, no, we lost Todd. I think Todd was going to say that you know, he's away from home a lot, and he thinks that the loss of community is the biggest problem for the way we feel and happiness.
He's so right to say that, as I said earlier, that it's not a kind of ideological thing. It has to do with how we've set up our economy and what we emphasize. What's really interesting is to go to some place like, say, Western Europe, which we think of as being, you know, more liberal or whatever than America, and to see that they've set up their economy in such a way that they don't have as much stuff. Their disposable income is maybe 2/3 on average what Americans is, even though they're just as productive as we are. They've taken a lot of that productivity in the form of time. So they have a lot more time to spend with their families, a lot more time. You know, they have average 8 weeks of vacation. They work, in many cases, 35 hours a week. And what do you know? Their divorce rate is a lot lower than ours. You tell me whether that's liberal or conservative idea that's underway there.
We're talking with Bill McKibben. He is a scholar in residence at Middlebury College, an environmentalist, a writer, a frequent contributor to many magazines, author of several books, including The End of Nature, and the just-published Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. And in it, he talks about how we might change the way we think about the things we buy, the food we eat, the energy we use, and the money that pays for it all, with an emphasis on buying local and building community, and asking what it is we really want from our economy, that these changes could result in more happiness for us and a better world, a better environment. 1-800-642-1234. We welcome your thoughts and questions for Bill McKibben. We wonder if you share this philosophy, if you're trying to do this already. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. We have an open line for you and time for you. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock, talking with her guest, reporter Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, after 9 o'clock about current issues, political issues in the news. That's coming up after 9 o'clock. We're talking about why more isn't necessarily better. And other issues, themes in the book, Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. Bill McKibben is the author of this new book, who will be in Madison, by the way, tomorrow. He will be having a lecture and a discussion at the First Unitarian Society of Madison. It's an event sponsored by the Wisconsin Humanities Council. That is going to be at 7 o'clock, Tuesday, March the 27th. Apparently it says here seats will be available on a first-come, first-served basis. Then in Milwaukee Wednesday night, March the 28th at 7 p.m., you'll be at the Harry Schwartz Bookstore in Shorewood at 7 o'clock. So you can see him at those events or talk to him right now, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Bill McKibben also promoting a nationwide series of events on April the 14th. It's a Step It Up events, and just noted on our website that at UW-Madison at noon on April 14th, a Step It Up rally saying that they want to have members of the community gather to partake in the largest rally yet. And again, this is to encourage Congress to step it up, Bill McKibben, to cut carbon emissions by 80% by the year 2050?
Exactly right.
Yeah.
And you know, it's possible that that's not enough. We've set in motion very large forces, and we have a very narrow window of opportunity to do anything about them. But this is our real last shot. Our leading scientists like James Hansen at NASA have told us that if we don't make real progress in the next 10 years, as he put it, we're going to live on a totally different planet. So that's what we're about.
Yeah. So isn't, bringing this that theme back to your book, too, isn't there some concern from our government leaders right now that if we would cut the carbon emissions, that it would cost our businesses a whole lot and the economies and businesses in China would take over?
We're going to have to. I mean, one of the reasons that the U.S. needs to cut its own carbon emissions is not only because they're by far the biggest in the world per capita. We produce four times as much CO2 as the Chinese, but also because if we take some action on our own, then we can get back in the game of discussing this internationally, that we can re-engage with China and India and try to nudge their developing energy trajectories in a new direction. If we don't, if we continue the current Bush administration policy of not engaging with the rest of the world on this question of walking away from the Kyoto Treaty and so on and so forth, then we have next to no chance of meeting the targets that we need to meet to deal with climate change.
To move for more phone calls, Kitty in Fort Atkinson. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. We have a citizens group here in Fort Atkinson. It's called Heart of the City, and we've started a local initiative in response to the global warming crisis, where we're asking the whole city to go on a low-carbon diet, and we're calling it the Atkinson Diet.
Very cute.
We have a website with that name, theatkinsondiet.com. And in response to what that man said earlier, I think part of what our hope is that these habit structures people have really are difficult to change, and that it will be easier to change them, we hope, through this community effort and community support of all of us attempting to do these things, which for some people are really difficult. Oh,
this is so cute, Kitty. How does Fort Atkinson go low carbon, though? What is one of the elements of the Atkinson diet?
Well, we're just asking people to do many of the things that you will read all over the web. There's certainly other people doing low carbon diets. Just the whole, you know, changing your light bulbs, just trying to reduce your energy usage, reduce your car usage by at least 5 miles a week by biking or walking or carpooling. And one of the things that I like to try to emphasize is that try to get people to just think differently. Don't view it as something you're giving up. View it as something you're gaining. It's isolated independence is not a good thing, as Bill points out, and that through some of these measures, there'll be this community interdependence. You'll be more likely to ask your neighbors to, if they need something, when you go on an errand so that they don't have to drive. So those things that people used to do because everyone didn't have five cars. It was required that you relied on your friends and neighbors, and that's not required now. I think people liked that then. I don't think they know what they've given up. And we're kind of hoping that through this diet, quote, we'll create a community conversation about these things, and then a community ethic will rise from that.
Thanks. So, thank you very much, Kitty. We're very clever, huh, Bill?
Not only really clever, but really heartening. She hits it right on the head when she talks about the ways that people really do want interdependence. And if you're sitting there thinking, oh, maybe this is unrealistic or whatever, you better turn off the radio, because the medium over which we're talking, public radio, is a perfect example of what I'm describing. I mean, think of how terrible the business plan for Wisconsin Public Radio is. You give away your product, and then a couple of times a year, you come on the air and hector people to send you a check for something that they get for free anyhow. So, by any rational economic understanding of the world, this would fail completely. But people like the product, and they like the community that product, that station represents. And so they support it, though they don't need to. It's a perfect example of what we need to build in a lot of other parts of our economy. And the level of satisfaction that it brings is so much higher than the kind of, what's the ExxonMobil or the Archer Daniels Midland of broadcasting? It's something like Clear Channel or Infinity or something. It doesn't do the same thing.
We'll have to have you back for the next fun drive. Jim in Ashland, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, good. Thanks for letting me on. I've been interested in this issue all my life, and have always tried to live simply on the earth. I think I'm a wealthy man in the number of things I can afford to leave alone. Henry David Thoreau. Anyway, last year I spent less than $2,000. I live on a subsistence farm south of Ashland, and pretty much feed myself from the farm. And just got done making maple syrup. The spring peepers started last night. Sky dance of the woodcock. We can live that way, but we need to do it. I've heard a lot of talk over the years, people wanting to do it, but very few people spend less economically than they have to, than they have. They talk it, but they don't live the walk. And I'm just saying, I'd like to tell people that it can be done. So I'll just keep quiet. And thank you for having the program.
That's a really good testimony. And, you know, I think he's right that there's sometimes it's just almost a fear factor, as someone was saying earlier, in doing something that's not what other people are doing at the moment. One of the things I describe in the book is deciding with my family that we would spend a winter, October to May, eating just out of the valley in which we live in Vermont, small valley along Lake Champlain. And we didn't know we could do it at first because we didn't know if there'd be enough things to eat and enough variety and whatever else. Turned out that we did remarkably well. You know, we ate real well. And we also, and here's the other point, made a dozen new friends in the course of the winter, farmers and food, you know, people making food and things locally, brewers and bakers. And we cleaned up on all accounts, and we've really never gone back to eating quite the way, you know, we never went back to orange juice. Apple cider does just fine, especially because it's twice as sweet knowing the people who grew the apples.
I was just going to, on the tip of my tongue was, so what about oranges or orange juice? It just, you can live without. Yeah.
It was easier for us because we don't drink coffee, but I think that's clearly a concession that has to be made. I think it's all right to keep drinking coffee, especially if you can find the good local roasters who are doing fair trade with the people growing it halfway around the world.
Well, I think Jim has a point. I mean, the stars and the maple syrup and the simple living that he's talking about, it sounds wonderful, but frankly, I'll have to admit, I'm probably too lazy to do it to the extent at least that Jim is doing it.
Well, of course, most of us are, and he's obviously an exception, and we don't need to move that far, at least, you know, right away. What we do need to do are start taking small steps that get us partway there. And, you know, each year become a little more enmeshed in the economy around us, buy more of our food locally, figure out how we can produce some of our energy, take local public transit, if it's available, 10 or 20% more often than we did before. Over time, and over not that much time, I think, we begin to sense the real pleasures involved in those shifts. It's sort of like exercise, you know. The first month of it's always a little painful because your body's getting used to it. After a month or two, you start to crave it if you don't get it that day. That's how habits work. And these are particularly pleasant habits to try to start building.
Thanks, Jim, for calling. Carlos in Madison is with us now. Hi, Carlos.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I am interested how, this is a very interesting concept, but I am interested how our energy economy fits in with this idea. I mean, energy is really a large-scale business, if not an international business.
Well, it is at the moment. It's really the paradigmatic example of a huge-scale business. I mean, you know, ExxonMobil last year made more money than any company in the history of companies, $40 billion in profit, which is one reason, by the way, that they've been able to keep any real action on global warming from happening. But energy doesn't need to be that way. Increasingly, we understand that there's a wide variety of diffuse energy sources that can be much closer to home. I mean, across the plains, people are really starting to rediscover the power of wind, and that offers all kinds of new options. Across America, people could be rediscovering or discovering for the first time the power of the sun. Here's an interesting fact. The two countries with the highest penetration of solar power for production of electricity, mostly on people's rooftops, are Japan and Germany. Neither of them particularly sunny. Neither of them anywhere near as sunny on average as even the northern parts of the U.S. But those are places where there's been enough political will to switch subsidies away from fossil fuel users and towards renewable energy, towards the future energy sources. And hence, they're building precisely the kind of robust, local power systems that we're going to be very, very grateful for if we have them a decade or so hence as the price of oil continues to spike.
Thank you, Carlos. Ken in Superior is with us now. Hi, Ken.
Hello, I just wanted to talk about our thermostat. We turned ours down from 60 last year, and we saved about $400, we figured. And then this year we turned it down to 55, and we saved another couple hundred. And we live on a 80-acre organic farm. We just had it organic. We raise all our own food. We have our own milk. We make cheese, butter. We ship to the organic dairy. I mean, and I don't think we bring our vehicle out of the garage more than maybe once or twice a week. I have no idea what we've saved there in fuel, but we've saved a lot. I don't start anything up, even a tractor, unless I absolutely have to have it.
Well, Ken's making me feel totally inadequate, too.
Joy, I don't think I even really need to come to Wisconsin. It sounds to me like things are well under control there.
Yeah, we certainly have, at least with the callers here. I'm sorry, Ken?
I found out that I'm much healthier when I turned it down to 60. My wife and I, neither one had a cold, and I'm 66 years old, and I haven't had a cold in the last 2 years. My wife hasn't. This year, we felt even better, and I don't understand it. It's about 45 degrees maybe up here today, and I'm in my T-shirt, and why can't you live in your house at 55 degrees?
People always ask me, you know, what magical thing do you heat with in your house? Because we keep the thermostat pretty low and so on and stuff, too. And I always say, oh, we have a secret heating ingredient. We heat with wool in our house, and when it gets cold, we put on a sweater. And there's a lot to be said for that, including the fact that you then have some cash left over to take down to the local farmer's market and buy some of that incredibly good-looking stuff with.
Yeah, some of that organic stuff that Ken is growing. Thank you very much, Ken. Diana in Tomahawk. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. And I hope I'm not repeating something because I came in late into the show, but I just wanted to follow up on this idea of the vastly under-tapped resource of conservation. One simple thing, which actually has been promoted a couple of times in the past year and a half by our utility, is to simply shut off your surge or power strip when your computers or electronic equipment are not in use for more than a couple hours. This is something that doesn't affect the quality of your life. It's simple to do. It doesn't affect your equipment. And, yes, it may only be 10 to 40 watts per household, but if you multiply that hundreds of thousands of times, you get the picture.
We have Diana, not enough time. Bill McKibben, less than a minute to go. Any reaction or final words?
Well, I mean, she's, of course, absolutely right, and it's emblematic of the fact that people are beginning to think about how to take a little more care than we have in the past. In an era when we just had nothing but cheap fuel and we weren't worried about the environment, we got careless. That carelessness is wreaking a toll on the environment. It's also, interestingly, taken a toll on the quality of our lives, which is why we need to think about these deeper economies, and it's why we need to take action on things like global warming, things like Step It Up 07.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Joy.
Bill McKibben, you too. Bill McKibben, author of Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.